From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Distracted, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
Oh, it's me, Ellen Burns Johnson. I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, and I, too, make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are pivoting and working on multiple projects. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
Did you get it? Because I was distracted.
Oh, that was on purpose.
That was intentional.
I totally believe it. You're too good an actor is what it is.
Yeah, well played.
Yeah, that's good. Ellen and I both have topics today that are really kind of just what we're up to.
Yeah, I suppose so.
But we do each have some stuff to talk about at the top.
Yeah.
But Stephen, before we get through a long episode of me and Ellen... the listeners have any news they should hear from you about?
I mean, okay, it's real minor and I don't have it. It's not finished yet.
So, like, okay, we're moving on then.
All right. No, it's really, it's, I've been working on a custom spirit for Spirit Island recently.
Ooh.
Which is kind of fun. But it's not like done.
Yeah.
And turns out making board game content is hard. Who would have thought? I don't really have much to present or anything yet.
Yeah.
I'm still working on it.
Okay.
I've just been doing that on the side a little bit here and there.
Yeah.
So it's been kind of fun.
That's fun. Mm-hmm. Are you like involved in a Spirit Island addiction support group that you want to share this with? Or?
Yes.
Cool.
I'll share it with them first and then I'll bring it to the table.
I feel like that's the sort of thing that I would love to be like, oh, show that to me. But like, I would not be able to give you any insight. I would just be like, I'm proud of you, boy.
I mean, I take those, man.
Yeah.
Oh, it was fun. Okay, y'all's news.
Okay. Ellen, go first.
We moved to Duluth. This is not new news. We talked about this several times.
Uh-huh.
One of the reasons we moved to Duluth is because Eric really wanted to kind of participate in a smaller town scene. Duluth isn't like a small town in terms of like Minnesota terms.
Yeah.
It's all relative. But one of the great things about Duluth is there's a very active music scene. So there are like three colleges in Duluth proper, plus more over in the other state, Wisconsin, across the river, and lots of music majors who are playing, and then lots of really involved community members. And so Eric has been definitely more involved than I have been, but he did loop me into a couple groups that we were playing with. So we've been playing with a low brass group, and so that's like tubas and euphoniums. If you don't know what that is, it's like a tiny tuba and trombones and just those instruments. And we had our concert like a week ago.
Okay.
And that was pretty cool. And then we've been playing with a swing band, a community jazz band. This is the first season for like a community jazz band. And we had our concert on Thursday. So we played Sweet Georgia Brown.
Nice.
We played Nostalgia in Times Square. And Eric played a lot of trumpet solos. And I play it on the penny whistle for two measures.
Nice.
Cool.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So that's what we were up to this last week. Some concerts.
And
it
that's
was
cool. I do like
pretty
the,
cool.
the musical adventure check-ins. That's
yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good to hear about those.
I like missed my opportunity to ever be a musical performer. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I want to write music. I don't need to learn instruments.
I mean,
so I never got good at anything. I learned to play a lot of instruments. I never got good enough to actually play it in front of anybody.
Sure.
And part of me is like, oh, I kind of wish I would have because it sounds so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is fun. Like just a couple weeks ago, we also had the Homegrown Music Festival here in Duluth. And so that's like a week long festival. It actually reminds me a lot of like the Fringe Festival down in the Twin Cities, except for instead of theater, it's all like locally rooted musicians. So all of the venues like open up and they have like 30 shows a night from musicians who don't necessarily live here anymore, but they got their start here. And they just like, it's like all kinds of genres and lots of bluegrass, which is popular up here, but then like also other things. And so just like, it's just been like very, really into the music scene up here. And Eric's, I'm not signing up for any new groups. But Eric is starting a couple, so it's going to be a thing he does. Yeah, so it's
cool.
It's like every new day, it's like, look at this cool new brass instrument I learned about. I should get it. If you can find room on your wall.
Yeah. Maybe just stick to trumpet, huh?
Yeah.
I'll stitch you guys a picture of Eric's brass wall. Yeah.
I would like to see that.
Nice. Okay. You got to stitch them all together and just get one really low note.
Like that. So that's my thing.
Okay. Cool. My thing is my car broke.
No.
And listeners will know I talk a lot about my bike on the show.
Yeah.
Because I like to bike around. Mm-hmm. But I'm also a person who lives in the 21st century. And so I have a little car. It's a smart car, you know, a two-seater. And it was a great car for me because I could get where I needed to go, but I could also leave it in the garage forever.
Yeah.
And I got to kind of have the satisfaction of like not driving a car.
Yeah.
Because it was like a toy instead.
Yeah.
So it's, a lot of it's psychological, right?
For sure.
But you know, it's the thing about cars that you learn when you drive a smart car is that you don't need anything bigger than a smart car.
Yeah.
Like, true. You know, I fit four people in there. It's not safe, but like also all the groceries you need and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I've always liked it. But no, the engine just completely kaput.
Aww.
It's a thing that happens.
Yeah.
And I was really bummed. We got towed to a shop.
Yep.
And they were like, sure, we'll replace the engine. It'll cost $9,000. And I'm like, that's about 50% more than I paid for that car.
Yeah. Probably not worth then.
I love that car so much. Yeah. And so it was like a crisis. It also, it's getting warm. So I'm driving less and less.
Yeah.
And so I'm definitely in like the headspace where I could just be like, oh, okay. You know, I had my time with it. Had it for 6 or 7 years. Let's just scrap it and then whatever. We'll move on. Mm-hmm. But like, I have to think rationally. I'm like, no, sometimes I do need to go to Roseville.
Yeah.
Like, you know. And so looking around and trying to, estimates a couple of shops, and they're like, well, maybe we could fix it and we cost this much. And it was still just so much more than we paid for it.
Yeah.
But the thing is that since I paid for it, the used car market has exploded.
Yeah.
And so it's not really so like, okay, well, let's look at replacements for the little car, right? Oh, let's look at the little EV microcars, which there are not a lot of in the United States. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's one coming out this fall.
Oh.
But it's like $20,000. It's like real car money.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not paying that for something I'm barely going to drive.
Yeah.
And so, I'm thinking like, well, I could either solve this problem now by paying a lot of money to fix the engine on this car, which might break in another year or two.
Yeah. Who knows?
Again, who knows? Or I could like get a permanent solution. I replace it with something I'm going to have for many years, like a little micro car or something. I definitely want an EV. But then that's going to cost so much. I'm not in the market for a new car.
Yeah.
So just like being forced to decide has been really frustrating because also the car was in the parking lot of this garage. So like we had to like kind of decide quickly.
Yeah.
But happily, Dale's mother, my wife's mother, lives two blocks away from this auto shop. Mm-hmm. And so, Steven,
yes.
We elicited your help.
Mm-hmm.
You, me, and Dale. Dale steered and you and I pushed the car in neutral.
Yes.
About four blocks, maybe five blocks.
Yeah.
Up two little hills.
Yep.
It was an ordeal.
Uh-huh. It was, though. I know it's a small car, but like my back is still recovering.
Still
yep.
Car.
And so we just rolled it so we didn't have to pay for a tow truck to my mother-in-law's driveway.
Mm.
And so now we can just decide what to do with it.
Yeah.
But I did decide what to do with it.
Yeah.
I found an EV version of this car in Virginia.
Oh.
So far away.
Yeah.
Virginia, not Virginia, Minnesota.
Right. Virginia. Birthplace of Thomas Jefferson.
Okay.
And there's other facts about Virginia, I'm sure. That might not even be true. That's how far away it is.
Yeah.
But it is pretty cheap, much newer than my. And the thing about these smart cars is that they're interchangeable panels.
Ooh.
So one of the things about having a little car you don't drive very much is it is like a toy.
Yeah.
And so it's a fun color.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, I want to shop for a new one. I don't want a silver one.
Yeah.
And so that's like a dumb thing.
Yeah.
But like, you know, matters to me because that's the thing. That's kind
of nonsense.
It matters to me.
Yeah.
Thing is all these cars have interchangeable body panels like Legos.
Yeah.
They were sold on that basis. Uh-huh. And so they didn't change the body design for like 6 or 7 years so they could keep that feature intact.
Okay.
So you could buy new panels and replace them yourself in an afternoon. And so this version of this car that I'm buying is 5 years newer, an EV, and has the exact same body components.
Mm-hmm.
So I can just swap it and just, so it's like, it'll be like I'm replacing the insides of the car, not the outsides.
Yeah.
But here's the thing is that there's a new federal EV tax credit. So not only is it a good price, but it's actually going to be cheaper than it would cost to fix the engine.
Ooh, nice.
To just replace the car.
Yeah.
It's a very weird, I don't know. I mean, Dale and I just bought a new electric car last year.
Right.
And that's her car. Mm-hmm. And I drive it sometimes. And every time I drive it, I'm like, this is not my car. Because like, I drive so much less than the last time we got a car.
Sure, sure.
Like the last car we had, it did feel like my car. Mm-hmm. This one doesn't. And so my little car was just my little car.
Yeah.
And so it was like a crisis that I was dealing with. Like there was a ticking clock attached.
Yeah.
And then searching online. And then I put down the deposit on this replacement. It's like $4,000 cheaper than the nearest. Because this market is so weird and volatile. The person who wants one of these cars, like I'm part of a small club.
Yeah.
So like prices are so wild because they're rare, but also nobody wants them. So like, you know, they go up and down.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll have an EV version of it and then nothing in my life will change.
I mean,
I'll plug it in.
You don't have to give it gas. You just plug it in.
Yeah, but I barely gave it gas to begin with.
Oh, I suppose that's true.
I filled it up like once a month, less than once a month.
Yeah.
And the thing has like a 5-gallon engine. Like, and that's my car story.
Wild. It landed on a happy note.
I don't know. Now that I got it completed, I'm like, I don't know that it was worth telling.
Oh, but, I enjoyed this.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
All right, Ellen, you've got a topic.
I do.
What is the topic?
I want to
real
talk about...
quick. If Martha was still here, she would have aced the transition on this.
Yeah, she's good.
We are so bad at this, the three of us.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh shoot. It's pivoting. That's my topic. Pivoting.
Ah, pivoting. Okay.
Right. And you know, like someone's gonna put the whole Friends meme, whatever, in the chat, and that's fine. You can come to Discord at dicegames.club/discord if you want to put the Friends meme about Ross yelling pivot about the couch in the
chat. I was gonna do that.
Okay, Steven can do it.
That's when I hear pivot. That's what I think of.
Somebody beat Steven to that, please.
It'd be funny if you beat Steven to it.
Yeah.
Lane, you're on. Go. So. Yeah, so I wanted to talk about this because some recent events at my job. We lost funding for a game we were going to make. We don't really know what happens. Funding in this space is not the same necessarily as funding in other game making spaces. But I mean, like,
okay,
this particular one was grant funded, and so we're not really sure what's going on. And we have calls set up for the next few weeks to figure that out or to learn more.
Yeah.
Not probably something I can talk about openly. Yeah. Like, okay. Once we do.
Can you maybe quick give listeners a recap on what this space means?
Yeah. So I work for a company that does, among other learning-based design and interactions, we do game-based learning. So, and gamification for learning purposes. Occasionally we do games like completely custom from the ground up. And this was one of those opportunities. They're not super common. And so we were really excited about it. And we did a whole design phase. We did like a few weeks of conversations with their whole team and made game design documents and submitted the game design documents and revised the game design documents. And then poof, money went away.
Ugh.
Yeah. So that sucked a lot. And so my topic is about what to do when that happens. And I also wanted to kind of explore it from at different levels of scale, right? So like this particular instance is like asking the whole team to pivot because we had a project, it's not there, everyone's got to find other things to do. But like you can also look at it as on an individual scale. And you could look at it at like a studio scale, right? It probably depends on how big the project is. But yeah, I just wanted to kind of talk a little bit about that. So I guess the first thing, I guess talk a little bit about the experience that I'm having now, and this has happened again in the past, was like this project didn't last as long as we thought it was going to, or it's lasting too long and someone else is going to take care of it, or you get your company gets fired on something. I don't know. I don't think that's ever happened to a project I've been on, but it's been a while. I've done a lot of projects. So I don't remember. but like what we're doing in this instance is, there's more stuff to do, right? There's more other stuff to do. Yeah. So our full-time game designer is going to take all of her attention and point it towards the platform for the near future. There are a couple other custom games on the horizon that she'll be able to look at once they hit. But for right now, it's all of her attention on one thing, which is a great way to get lots of progress on that one thing. And for me, I always have 80 things to do at this point because I'm not in a game design role full time, right? So right. I just turned back to the thing that was already my full time job, which is managing a team. But like that works for us because the game studio is, or the game team, development team in this company is part of a much larger company. And there's this ongoing platform work, which I think is a smart way to set up that kind of business, because if you're an agency full-time, then it's just like the winds, like the capricious business environments are going to buffet you no matter like at any direction.
Right.
When you have like a product that, you know, people are subscribing to and there's ongoing investment, then you can like pivot your core people back to that product when you have periods where there isn't a lot of customer work.
Can you say, or hint at anyway, just, the percentage of business that your company does based on this, the platform and the clients that are subscribed to that platform versus custom games, just to get a sense of like how big a hit this is. Because I think in your tone and as you sort of hinted at us, this is news to Steven and I as well.
Right.
But it does seem like a really big hit for the company. But you're also describing that you have this like foundation of stability. Give us, if you can, give us a sense of like, I guess, with what side of 50% that you live on right now with where it is.
Yeah.
Or if you even know.
Well, that's interesting. So the company overall makes more revenue from projects than from product. But baked into the budget is the assumption that the products will have dedicated development teams.
Okay. Right.
Right. So the impact in the short term isn't particularly rough for people who are full time at the company.
Right.
Designers. We were like our design director, we had a game designer, and we had a lead engineer who were all going to be like moving their focus onto the custom project. And then we were going to be pulling in, I think, a couple contractors to do additional game development work. And then there are a bunch of designers that we have, or artistic designers who we have over in India who have other work that they can work on. So, So we're not hiring those contractors, right? Because there's no projects to hire them from. But in terms of like the impact to the full-time people, there's not that much because, yeah, we weren't pulling a lot of people from the product side to the project side to get the work done, because that's also, you also don't, while it can give you some flexibility, you also can't just like pull people off and on again and actually like develop a product. So,
So it sounds like the product is part of its design and structure, as you were sort of alluding to with the sort of business case, is to allow the company to handle variations in project work. But it wasn't designed to replace project work or grow to supersede it at any point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is maybe going a little afield, but like from a business perspective, product is probably more valuable long-term because that is in the technology, right? Like, it's out there. It's a working code base. It's out there on the, there's a platform people log into. They have their content on it and they can, it's there. And you can, it's not like you can just ignore it forever because things will eventually update and then like technology moves on and your old stuff will break. So you can't just ignore it, but it's, the value is already realized and the ongoing value will continue for a reasonable amount of time without significant additional investment or without like highly skilled people from day one if you needed to replace everybody. It's not saying it's easy to replace a product development team.
Yeah.
Like from the ground up, it's super hard. Don't do that. but like when it comes to project work, to be successful, you need like experienced people managing your projects. Otherwise, you're just going to run over budget all the time. And those people can just, they can just leave. And then you lose all that knowledge unless you've been really dedicated about capturing it. And you have to capture it in such a universally usable way that it'll be easily followed by the next person. So it's a lot more, more of an oral tradition, I guess.
Sure.
which, you know, even if it brings in more revenue, say on a given year, long term, like you're looking at like getting like new investors or whatever, it's less valuable because it's less sticky.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In times that I've worked for studios in my former career in commercial video, just that, I mean, this, if you ever watch Mad Men, that's why there's two departments. There's accounts and creative. Like there's, and they're equally important.
Yeah.
Right. Because like doing the work requires a lot of work just to be able to start doing the work.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
From people who are experts in something other than the work.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I see where you're coming from.
Right.
I haven't had that, like, specific experience. I think when it comes to like pivoting on something, it would be more, it would be related to like the specific project and changing the direction of the project.
Yeah, I guess that's the question for you, Ellen, is that when you're thinking of, I mean, when you titled this topic, are you thinking about the company pivoting towards a different model or focusing on new clients, or what is the pivot we're talking about? Yeah. Or at least proposing or musing on it.
Well, I think, I feel like there's probably some things that are consistent about the act of deciding to pivot and then executing it, regardless of like what scale of story you're looking at, you know? So like we've had several people on the show who we've asked about the shape of their career, and they're like, well, I did this, and then that led me to this, and then that led me to this. And I think that describes like those moments describe sort of pivots where they're deciding to do something different.
I see.
You know, so that's an individual pivot. And right, I think that we could look at what leads up to one of those things and what happens when you actually do it. I think a team pivot is like what's happening here, where it's like, okay, we were having a team together and now it's not happening. So we're going to shift our focus back to other things that we were maybe preparing to push off to the periphery for a while we worked on this thing for a while, and now we're just going to bring them back into focus. And then I think there's like the studio level. So like, what was the studio who made Hi-Fi Rush with all that drama recently?
Oh gosh.
Well, whatever they are, they're no longer a going concern because Microsoft shut them down.
Yes.
Right. So that is, Tango Gameworks was the developer, right? And Microsoft shut them down. So all those people are like, it's a whole thing, whole group of people. And I guess that's maybe not a studio saying we need to pivot, because that's a studio like shutting down. So maybe that's more of like a...
Well, it's Microsoft pivoting in an inscrutable way that I'm sure makes sense to them.
Yeah.
That's part of why the story got traction, is people could not understand why.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And to give Microsoft and the Xbox game studio family the benefit of the doubt, which I don't know that they deserve, but let's just give them the benefit of the doubt.
Okay.
Like they're not morons. Like they did it for a reason.
They did it for a reason.
And I don't know, you know, it was either a bad decision or a good one, but it was a hard decision either way.
Probably.
And so I think that speaks to the difficulty of understanding the pivot from the outside, right? Like you need to really understand the context of what you're working on to make any sense of it. So it is at the individual level or at the small studio level or at the team level, it's probably a pretty lonely exploration.
Sure.
Because you can ask for advice, but you probably can't get a lot of good advice.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the advice might lead to the pivot. I was thinking about like with respect to like Future Club, you know, we were trying to pitch this horror game for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And the budget was really big because we have a lot of animators and the way that we do animation is all hand drawn. It's expensive. But like we thought that like our animation would be a very high selling point. People would jump on it. No one had. And so like we've pivoted by changing the budget size and the scope of the game to match that.
Yeah. Great example.
And it's And so it's led to, well, it made some difficulties because like, well, speaking personally, I wasn't sure how I had only really known about this project from the large scale that it was before.
Right.
So thinking about it from a game that is a quarter of the budget.
Is this the game you still want to work on?
Not even is the game that I still want to work on. What is this game even? How are we going to complete it?
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about it this way, and now we're talking about it when it's half the size, a quarter of the size. And we're talking about it as though we can make that change without like really getting into the details.
Oh.
So the way that we handled it is we like had some meetings. We had we figured we picked somebody to be the lead on it. And they like basically owned the project, and they described how we wanted, how the game was going to work, like our plans for such and such, we're handling pre-production, how we're handling production, how we're handling post-production, all that stuff. I'm going to get this game made, because like that was just kind of vague to me. Mm. And I mean, I think I've been upfront about this on the show before, but like for a period of time when we were working on the vertical slice for this game, there was a period of time when I was kind of crunching. I was not kind of, I was crunching.
Yeah.
For like a month, just that long a time, but it's, you know, it, any amount is bad. And so like just seeing that and seeing like how we're describing how we're going to make this game for less money, but in a shorter period of time.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know how this is going to work. And so like having that, having that explained to me, at least even just having somebody who, owns the project, and can make those decisions made me feel a lot more comfortable with that idea.
Right.
But beforehand, it's very difficult to just say, oh, we're going to go in this direction now without getting everybody on board first.
It really speaks to the communication dimension of it, right?
Yeah.
Like because everyone is still thinking about the old way.
Right. Right. And exactly.
Not even necessarily because they're fighting to get it back or even that they're mourning its loss.
Yeah.
It's just because that's what they've been doing all this
time. Right. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So it's just difficult to make that change. Somebody just has to lead it. I hesitate to use the word visionary, but like, well, kind of what it is. Just somebody has to point the direction and tell everybody this is what we're doing.
How does that represent? Does that represent a change from how the project was organized previously? Was there not a project?
There was. Things shifted. I don't want to go into details.
Oh, no, sure. So what you're saying is that what happened is that because the change in direction and scope and budget and all of that, there was a sort of a restart and somebody took on a new role or new to them as a leader.
Yes. So, Yeah.
And that big part of their job getting going was that like coming up with what it was going to look like, but also making sure everybody knew.
Yeah.
That seems to be almost I'm biased by how you've described it, but it seems like that was the most important job of that for that person for a good look.
In that moment, yeah, it was. Yeah. But it was just really helpful to have that direction because, I literally could not even envision doing this the way that we were describing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's from a studio perspective.
Yeah. Well, I think Ellen hit it earlier. It all scales, I think.
Yeah.
There's universal lessons.
Yeah.
Ellen, I suspect that you and your team are early in this process, but have you thought about that? Decisions need to be made, but then there's the fallout of those and the communication of that. Is that something that you're prepared for or have already sort of sorted through?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's actually already been sorted through, but I think it's just because we got lucky. I think, we got lucky, but also we're set up to be flexible in that way to a certain degree. So we got lucky in that the producer who was going to be leading up the project had also been working on another project, which then like is really struggling. So it's taking up more of his time. So, he's got something to do.
Yeah.
And the game designer that we hired because we were planning for this project amongst other things. But for the timing was definitely around this project. There's a ton of work to do on the product. It's just been languishing because I stepped out of that game design role and then had no time to help. Okay. So they have all this pent up demand and excitement to do work on the platform. That's going to be pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And she just pivoted entirely to that. And so we had that. And I obviously had my other thing to do. So and our lead engineer is, very immersed in the product code base. So he can just be there. And help do things.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
If he needs to, we just got lucky. And, well, it's not just luck. Like we were designed to be lucky.
You entered an environment where you could take advantage of any luck that came your way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But I doubt it's your new game designer. That feels like because that's a frustrating position to be in. Be hired for a particular thing, and then everything changed so quickly.
Yeah. Within like
at least what you've said so far is that. They've taken to this change in a way that I think that feels like lucky for the company.
That
suited them pretty well.
Well, and that's the thing is I don't think we would have hired them if we hadn't had more than one thing. We would have.
Okay.
You know, I mean, like.
So maybe not as big a shock to them.
Yeah.
Maybe just for the company.
We have them on a contract. So it could have been like the work isn't here. Bye.
Yeah.
But there was other work. So that worked out okay. And so I guess like that's one lesson, is that depending on your space, you might want to design your approach to your work in a way that makes it easy and not as painful to pivot.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's potentially an easier practice in the industry I'm in, because the games tend to be smaller. Sure. And so you don't necessarily expect a project to last like 2 years. Yeah. Certainly some of them do. And that has happened. Yeah, it's not the case for everybody. Sometimes the project's going to last 5 years, you know? And yeah. So if the circumstances around it change significantly, where you're thinking like, we need to make a pivot, that's going to be painful no matter what. And
yeah.
I guess the only other thing I really wanted to talk about was like, even if you can't necessarily set up your systems of your work in a way that prevents those moments of pivoting from being painful. Mm-hmm. Certainly like you're not usually sometimes you're pivoting from something that suddenly became bad to something that's less bad, but how do you continue to feel good about it? You know, like, cause like so much of what game development is requires like this almost like a faith degree of emotional engagement. Like you have to believe the project is fun, that is worth your time. Otherwise you're not emotionally engaged in it and you won't have
a lot of investment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like how do you maintain that kind of positive attitude and like positivity towards your work that enables that kind of emotional engagement when the ground is shifting?
Yeah. I'm just thinking about examples, you know, that I've experienced probably maybe outside the scope of this topic exactly, but reminds me of things where like things change. The key for me in those environments has always been like, you can't spend a lot of time mourning the loss, right? Because you can get resentful.
Yeah.
And you do kind of have to like decide what you like about the new thing, and you kind of have to do it in a vacuum. It's a little bit of self-delusion perhaps, but you kind of have to, because those things are real.
Yeah.
But the more you compare them, because the math is also real, like it's not as good as it used to be or whatever.
Yeah. Personally helps me feel more comfortable with the decision. It's like, there's a reason you made the decision, and I would like to think people at least talked about it and explained this decision to you or included you in that process.
Yeah.
And that allows you to feel comfortable with the idea that even though this is different from what you initially wanted to do, it makes sense why they're making this decision, why the thing is changing in the way that it is.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's a little bit like Ellen was saying, it's a little bit of faith in respect to that. Yeah.
So, Ellen, you talked about like going from a bad to a less bad situation as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe we can talk about, maybe to wrap this topic up, we can talk about like elective pivots where that is sort of like that, where you're sort of choosing to either make a sacrifice or drop a client or learn a new skill that's going to make you less money.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are other electing to sort of make those hard choices rather than being it imposed upon you, which is often when we're forced to do this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like when because all these same lessons apply, but there's definitely the comfort and the status quo, right? Of just like, well, this isn't great, but it's working.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Or like, oh, I could see this falling apart if we let it go, but that's a future problem. Uh-huh. Or whatever. You know, like how do you develop pivoting as like a practiced skill almost?
Oh, good question.
Considering how rarely you hope to ever do it.
Right.
You know.
Well, I guess it comes back to two things, actually, now that you put it that way. It's a really great question, and I like the way you phrased it. I think it comes down to playing with pivots at different levels of that scaling that we talked about, right? So like, mm-hmm. There's that individual kind of pivot. There's like the team pivot, and then there's like the organizational pivot. And the top one is very challenging to manage and difficult for the people involved. The team one, depending on your team culture and your people and how you run things, might be more painful, or might just be like, it's just another month and we're going to try a different thing. And then the personal one, I think, same kind of thing. And I think, maybe similar to like the team one, it depends on how much you do it, right? So like,
mm-hmm.
I think what it comes down to is like, making a practice of regularly examining what you value and whether you're following through on that.
Yeah. Okay.
And that applies to like your own time. And it also applies to like your team, whether they're working on a game or a feature or rugby I don't know.
Okay.
That is incredibly insightful, I think, because what you're describing is like an elective pivot is one thing, but what you're describing is choosing not to pivot. Is when you make those regular assessments, then that you can develop that practice. Like, let's keep going. Like we've analyzed it. We've made the choice to keep going.
Yeah.
That this is the right direction, so that when it's time to make a change, mm-hmm. you have experience making that decision.
Yeah.
Right. That's yeah. what I'm hearing from you anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly it, because I think it comes from like leading up to a pivot first becomes a question. Yeah. First, you have to recognize that one is necessary, and then you have one might be necessary. Then you have to examine it, decide whether it is, and then you have to decide to do it. Right. So like
right.
if you are regularly doing the first step, then you are making that a lot easier on yourself. It just becomes a matter of course. This is just something that you're doing. And if you do that regularly, you might find yourself making small changes, not necessarily big pivots, but that still makes the big pivot a little bit easier because you've been practicing making those small changes.
Right.
So right. I think that's part of it. I think that you might not necessarily be able to practice doing like full on pivots regularly, and that might be really disruptive, but you mm-hmm. can make it more likely that you are going to actually follow through with a pivot when it is necessary, if you practice like regular self-examination, whatever size unit you are looking at, right? This is yourself, your team, or like your larger organization. And I like, what is our purpose here? What is our goal here? Mm-hmm. What are we trying to do? Is that still right? You know, asking yourself those yeah. questions yeah. regularly makes yeah. them feel lower stakes to ask.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. I mean, you've also described a framework with those little changes, right? That give you the opportunity to make those little changes. So you can take, we're sticking in the world of metaphor here. You can take a wide curve around the bend instead of going right up to the corner and taking a sharp left, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, in which case you may never need to do the big pivot.
Yeah.
I mean, wishful thinking, but like you're at less risk of being taken by surprise. Exactly what you said, which is just you keep an eye on it and make those adjustments. And then you may find yourself after a year you're going in a different direction, but it wasn't a sudden adjustment.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that either. I had thought of just like the practice of the mental reflection and making changes helps you practice change. But it could also be that if you're practicing that reflection regularly, you might preclude the need for a sudden change because you've already been incrementally going that direction. In the preceding like however much time. I don't think it's always going to work that way. Sometimes like...
No, you're totally right. Because there's going to be outside... There's going to be things... You need to insulate yourself against the things you can't account for. Yeah. So regular assessment isn't going to make you any more likely to understand the random thing that strikes.
Right.
But you take it from maintenance, right?
Yeah.
It's just so that you are essentially mostly at risk from the big random things mm-hmm. and less the things that you can have control over, I suppose. But that kind of opens it up to a whole different thing. The way you described it, I was like, oh, that speaks to something bigger. But maybe that's outside the scope of this topic.
I mean, it's all like, it's just like, man, I don't know.
We'll have to pivot on it for another topic.
Oh, that it almost worked.
Stephen, try again.
I couldn't commit. I couldn't do it.
Stephen, try again.
Jeezy. No.
Okay.
I feel scummy enough as it is.
Could you try a couple more times if you turn off the microphones?
No. Oh, hilarious.
We'll have to use Martha's all-purpose transition.
All right. So, turns out making a podcast costs money. It's not free. I was sold on the idea of being free, but I think Mark was like footing the bill for it a lot of the time.
My technique is generally to forget that I've spent money on it.
Uh-huh.
And then I don't have to think about it.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking about it now, and I'm making you, listener, think about it too. We could use some help. We would appreciate your assistance. You can provide us with a little extra cash to help us fund this program on our Patreon. patreon.com/nicegamesclub. It's not just a one-sided transaction. You also get some benefits. Mm-hmm. Ad-free episodes, mm-hmm. a bunch of extra content. There's a lot of new content from GDC that we just recorded recently that I'm sure you'll be interested in. A lot of stuff like that. It helps us continue to keep the lights on. That's important because it's difficult to record a podcast when you can't see the other people. So if you go to patreon.com/nicegamesclub, donate any amount, help us out, we'd very much appreciate it.
Steven, are you done? I had my fingers on my ears the whole time.
Yeah, I'm okay. No more talking about money.
Okay, good.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, you know that topic. It's time for the next one. Hey.
All right, I have a topic today.
Yes.
It is working on multiple projects.
Okay.
Which is like, why haven't I talked about this already?
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like my whole deal.
It's like your episode one or something, like, right? I
mean. You know, I'm a little wary of this, like, I don't want to build a reputation for myself of being like, I'm the guy with a lot on my plate, because like that can feel really icky to be, to like boast, you know, like, I mean,
yeah.
But I'm sort of that guy, and...
Well, it just feels particularly more real in this moment.
It does, and the reason I want to talk about it now is because the things I'm working on are a little more concrete. I think generally I have a lot of things going, and then I have like one or two big things and a lot of little things, and I can set something aside for a week or 2 weeks and come back to it for a couple hours, or I can focus on something for like 3 weeks steadily and then set it. Like that's kind of, it's a little bit randomly scheduled.
Sure.
I would say.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot of that in my life as a freelancer when I was doing graphic arts and motion graphics and video production. Mm-hmm. Just like what Ellen, you were talking about with the sort of work that you do, mm-hmm. projects are shorter, right? And that I come out of that world where like the longest thing would be a month.
Yeah.
You know, and that's probably shorter than even what you deal with. And there'd be lots of 4-day projects and like things. So I developed a lot of respect for production producers mm-hmm. and production managers who could like schedule your time.
Yeah.
Like, this is what you're working on today. Like,
yeah.
Great. I'm pleased.
That is nice.
Let me know tomorrow what I'm working on and I'll do that. But you know, you don't know, you're not always in that environment. A lot of times you do have to make those judgments. And I've definitely developed a skill for making those judgments.
Yeah.
And I've leaned on that really hard.
I see.
And I don't know that I should be forcing myself to do that so much.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm in a position now where I have a couple of projects that I've decided to prioritize, a couple of things I've set aside. I wasn't making enough progress, so let's not waste 3 hours randomly on a Tuesday on it.
Yeah.
And I've now broken up my week into days I work on certain things.
Okay.
This is not a new idea for people who, you know, have this sort of thing going on.
Yeah.
It's basically just having multiple part-time jobs. That's all it really is. Uh-huh. But it's sort of new to me because it requires a kind of discipline that I've not really been good at.
Okay.
Which is the starting and stopping.
Yeah.
Sure. I have an addictive personality, and so whatever I'm doing now is what I'm happy to do till the end of time.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I start something else, I'll be happy to do that until the end of time. So switching gears is very difficult, and then when it happens, it's like permanent.
Yeah. Okay.
And so it's... It's a irritating existence, but it has been productive for me. Mm. And because I've developed a lot of skills in my life as a freelancer, and it's hard to know how much of this is professional experience versus just like my sort of personality and what I'm geared towards.
Okay.
I think they found each other
mm-hmm.
in my 20s and like they was able to make a career out of it. Mm-hmm. But definitely now I'm and as I work on more projects with more people, and needing to find ways to interface with other people on regular schedules, have regular updates, and also to give myself space to like kind of keep these projects in my mind at the right scale.
Yeah.
Because what often happens is I'll be working on something and I'll get kind of ahead and I'm like, okay, great. I can set that aside for now. And I can focus on this other thing for like a week.
Yeah.
And that'll get so much done.
Yeah.
And then that really did work for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying something new, which is just much more rigid. And I've been doing it for a couple weeks. Yeah. It's going kind of good.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask.
I've cheated like once.
Okay.
And
well, sometimes things come up.
Yeah, yeah, but that's a better record than I would have expected of myself.
Okay.
So I have two big projects I've talked about on the show before. I'm working on Dream Settler.
Yeah.
And that is a game that I was hired part time on, mm-hmm. and then increased my work and rate commensurately. Yeah. But it's still technically not a full time job. Yeah, it never really was.
Okay.
But it was also supposed to have shipped by now. Maybe not by now. That would have been really optimistic, but it would have shipped nearby. And that's not happening. 2025 that's what we're saying.
Yeah. Okay.
We need more schedules on this project.
Yeah.
That's another thing to talk about.
Sure.
But what that means is that I don't have enough time in the rest of my week to like start a big new project.
Right.
Okay. I'm sort of attached to this.
Yeah.
And so in order to do anything else, I need to really carve out time for it. Otherwise, I'll be just taking off time to work on that.
Yeah.
And that is what I have been doing the past year.
Okay, yeah.
I think I just need to change that. And so I talked to the team and let them know that's what I was doing.
Okay.
Like, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, that's my Dream Settler time.
Okay.
And so we have our weekly meetings on Tuesdays. It's a good thing. It kind of wraps up my time on the project. That's still, frankly, not enough for what I need to do.
Sure.
So I still work 10, 12-hour days.
Okay.
But I need the rest of the days because the other things I'm working on.
I mean, honestly, that scheduling that you're describing might get the rest in gear, maybe, so they can get their act together in those 3 days.
We'll see.
That's idealistic thinking, I guess. But
yeah. I mean, I've been pretty happy with the team dynamics, but like it's the three of us and we don't have a producer. So I've talked about it on the show before. Like it has been, I've been trying to impose a little production discipline on the team, but also it's not my place to.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a crisis either. It's just, you know, it's a small indie team and we don't have a framework for it.
Been in that boat before.
Yeah. And, you know, things ship with that. I'm not that worried about it because it's been going on long enough now to the point where it's like, it's time to get this game finished.
Yeah.
Rather than impose a big change on the project, I'm just going to try to like control how I engage with it so that this, what it is, works for me.
Right.
And that's where I am with it now. And I'm very satisfied with that part of it. So it sounds a little bit like I'm sort of complaining about there was a problem.
No, you're setting your boundaries.
Yeah. So then Wednesday is we do IDG ATC events on Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. And 2 of the 4 weeks, we have 4 Wednesdays a month, we do events.
Yeah.
2 of them I'm involved in.
Yeah.
One of them is Twin Cities Playtest, which we do here at Noble Robot. And one of them is the game dev meeting, which I sort of help coordinate and organize. Not as involved with running the show there, but I attend. So those Wednesdays are, especially the Playtest Wednesdays, a big chunk of my day is setting that up.
Yeah.
Way more than I wish it was. And then because I work in the evenings, as an evening event, it eats into my workday.
Yeah.
So those Wednesdays are not lost, but they're not a lot. So Wednesdays is my like other project day.
Okay.
And right now I'm working on a game called Operators, which I've talked about on the show before. It's a mobile game that I rescued from an old archive. Maybe we'll find the episode where I talk about why I pulled this. But I basically took off from everything else and I worked on it for about a month and a half, getting everything up to speed. And then I had to stop doing that.
Yeah.
It wasn't ready to ship yet. It got close, but I needed to get back to the rest of my life. So that's a 1 day a week thing now, and it'll just be done when it's done.
Okay.
And it's very slow and it's frustrating, but I'm like, Wednesday is my day for that. Mm-hmm. And Wednesday is my most disruptive day of the month. And so that's the project that is most acceptable to disrupt.
Sure. Okay. Right?
Yeah. By a long shot, I bet.
Yeah. Thursday, Friday is this new project that I've hinted a little bit, but it's not announced yet.
Yeah.
I'm in love with this thing. I'm so excited about it.
Yay.
It's a smaller scope project than Dream Settler, but I would describe it as the other big thing I'm working on.
Okay.
And so Thursday and Friday are my days for that.
Cool.
But Thursdays, we watch Star Trek in the evenings.
Right.
And Fridays, we record the show.
Yeah.
And so, again, some disruptions there. Mm-hmm. But again, this project is a little less sensitive to disruptions than Dream Settler is.
Okay.
So it works. And then Saturday, is my like wild card day.
Ah.
It's, you know, it's where I can have a weekend if I want one.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I feel a little bit like I'm just saying like, oh, I'm so busy. But I honestly am definitely the type of person where like it is relaxing for me to work on things I like.
Yeah.
And because I've been able to choose a career of doing things that I like, I'm not complaining about that. I don't feel stressed more. Like sitting around watching TV or reading is great, but I could also draw a bunch of assets for a project that I personally invested in.
Yeah.
That is relaxing, right? Sure. So, which isn't to say that like work is not work, but I just want to remove that context of like that all seven of my days are like scheduled for something.
Yeah.
You can read that into it that is overbooked, but that's not how I think of it.
Yeah. That's not how I'm perceiving it. Right. The way you're describing it to me anyway.
Right. I mean, I'm a restless person as well, so there's a little bit of that. It's like having something to do is important for my mental health.
Mm-hmm.
But so Saturday's my swing day. I can do what I want. I can anything that's built up over the week. So that includes like maintenance for any of the other things I'm doing. So like Nice Games Club, we have, you know, we pay Max, our booker, and I'm behind on a bill for that. But he owes me some money, so it kind of all balances out. So I have to do the math on that.
Right.
So that and I also have to, you know, check a couple of the other just sort of like little things. I'll look into the t-shirt sales.
Ooh.
We make like 30 cents per shirt.
Oh, okay.
NiceGames.club/shirt. It's not a profit driver for us. But I'm going to do all that accounting tomorrow, and that's also when I'm going to do some of the things related to Noble Robot, the business.
Okay, yeah.
And so, but every week is different. It's whatever's left on my plate. That's really important to me because it means on like Tuesday afternoon, I'm not being like, oh, I've got all these things. I could take care of it. I'm like, nope, I'll wait till Saturday.
Yeah.
Urgent things obviously have to be done urgently.
Right.
But that's been the principal benefit I've found from this system. And it just seems such like a simple insight, which is just like, you know, the difference between urgent and high priority.
There is, right?
Something needs to be done now. Or something needs to be done, or something really needs to be done.
Right.
Those are not the same thing.
Yes.
And so I've definitely, that's how I catalog all of the issue trackers that I set up for Dream Settler, but making sure the difference between priority and urgency.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been really good for the team to like sort these things. Like, this is really important, but we can do it 3 months from now.
Yeah.
And that's prevented us from losing track on stuff. So I've already implemented that kind of framework in a lot of my work.
Okay.
But actually doing it on my schedule has been really beneficial. It's relaxed me a lot about like, this is not the day for this.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm a little embarrassed to say it, like, this is very new to me when it's kind of, that said, this may not last.
Yeah.
Right? Because I have the projects that they fit into a week.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, who's to say it wouldn't fit better if I did 4 days of this and then 2 days of this and 3 days? You know what I mean? Like, and then, you know, there's nothing magical about a week other than it's easy to keep
track of. We arbitrarily made that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, but, you know, what if Dream Settler needed 4 days in a row? Or else, one of the advantages of picking one thing and working on it until you're exhausted of it and then switching to the other thing is there's a lot less wind up and wind down time.
Yeah.
And I have made that work for me over the years where I will be on a tear on a project as something else sits in waiting.
Yeah.
It's hard to measure that sort of thing, but I've definitely felt, I've seen the pluses and minuses of doing things that way.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that has surprised me both that I've been pretty good at this so far is that I've found stopping points that have worked for me. I think operators that I work on Wednesdays is probably the one where I spend the most of time during the day getting back up to speed.
Sure.
So there's a lot of heat loss going on there.
Yeah.
But on the two big projects, not as much.
Okay.
That I can tell.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's been, I was like, as soon as I see a sign of that, then I'll be ultimately losing a day of the week to starting and stopping.
Yeah.
And then it can't do it. I'll 1 week at a time for a project. I came up with a couple of different ways to handle it.
Yeah.
But this is working for me.
Okay.
But part of it is like, I wonder how much of it is situational.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of it is that on the new project, I'm building a lot of new systems. They're very small. I can knock one out in a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can do polish on a previous one. Like, it fits into a 2 day thing.
Yeah.
And on Dream Settler, I'm currently working on a pretty big system that is kind of steady, but it's like the bookmarks I leave are really obvious.
So okay.
I don't get, you know, but that's not always going to be the case for projects.
Right.
The other thing is that I'm changing programming languages.
Oh, God.
And in the case of Unity, I'm using different frameworks. So in on Dream Settler, I'm using the built-in render pipeline, We're using sprite renderers, but we're containing them inside rect transforms.
Yeah.
It's a totally non-standard way of doing it. Mm-hmm. And we built it up. We're using very few. We're not using any of Unity as event systems. We built our own. We built a lot of our own systems. And this project is now almost 3 years old. That's what Unity is to me.
Yeah.
And on this new project, I'm still using Unity 2022. I'm not upgrading to Unity 6 because we still don't know.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Same.
But I'm using the Universal render pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
I got a good amount of time with last year,
mm-hmm.
and appreciated its value, and it's finally stable.
Yeah.
So I'm using it on the new project, which means I'm relearning how to write shaders, which I'm not good at anyway. Mm-hmm. And I'm using the standard sort of event systems for buttons and UI stuff. And the thing about Dream Settler is it's a game about UI, which is right. why we had to build it from scratch.
Yeah.
We couldn't just use Unity's system. It'd be way too limiting.
Yep.
But this new project has a lot of UI in it, and I'm just using all of Unity's systems. And I'm like, why am I feeding this a game object as the selected object instead of the button component? It doesn't make any sense. I'm like, oh, right. There's all this black box magic that Unity has.
Yeah.
You add a box collider to an object, and then suddenly you now have access to the on trigger enter callback.
Yeah.
Which is like, it's like magic. It doesn't make any sense.
Doesn't make any sense.
And we built Dream Settler where you can see the lines from thing to thing.
Right.
Because it's too big a project to let any of that magic bridge the gap.
Yeah.
I learned a lot of Unity on Widget Satchel, and that was the thing that bugged me the most about it. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't mind wiring something up if I can see it.
Yeah.
But like, all these things sort of working on their own, it means I have to remember it.
Yeah.
How it's all stitched together. And it's like, why does this work with this, even though there's no interface that connects them? It's like, Unity.
Like, yep.
It's supposed to be relieving, but it's stressful.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm working more the Unity way on this new project mm-hmm. because the scope is a lot smaller. Right, it just doesn't need as much of that stuff.
Need all of it, yeah.
But then I go back to Dream Settler on Sunday, and I'm just like, oh, right. Like, this is, this makes more sense to me.
Yeah.
But also, it's more complicated, but I designed it, so I know it really well.
Yeah.
And so, there's a little bit of that going on. And then on Wednesdays, I'm writing an action script, which is a language that nobody even uses anymore.
Boy, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And with an eye towards porting it, because ultimately, once it's done, I'm going to make a web version, and it's going to be Apache Royale, MXML. No one needs to know about this.
Okay.
The future of operators is as a JavaScript framework. And so as I'm building it out, I'm also depreciating bits of the code that I know can't be easily changed.
Ah, okay.
And so thinking all that, and on my, just to finish the different things topic, on Saturdays, I sometimes work on Noble Engine, which is my game engine for Playdate, which is in Lua. And so there are three different languages, four different frameworks, and I can do them all throughout the week. And I've always kind of prided myself on the fact that I know a lot of these systems, but I'm definitely doing the thing now where I'm typing in the wrong syntax.
Oh,
I'm doing it all the time.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Because like for loops look the same, but like declaring a function looks different. And it's like, I would kind of wish there was just a way you could just say like, just, you know what I mean. It's like, they're not even different languages in a sense. It's the APIs are the things that are really different.
Yeah.
And then, then the under the hood stuff, but I'm not that kind of engineer. Performance matters to me, but I don't design for performance, at least at the front. So just let me, it's weird how similar, when the languages are similar enough, you get really lost in like the little differences. And then you'll be just staring like, why is this? Oh, right. It's not that. It's just put on the other side of the thing. So anyway, I'm not keeping track of how much time I'm losing to that.
Okay.
But I'm feeling very productive.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Every day has purpose. Mm. I'm not deciding what to do every day. Mm-hmm. I feel like that saves a lot of time.
Yeah.
But I'm also very nervous about like how situational this is and how much I'm just on the high of it, like of me not being stressed about how much longer I'm going to work on this and the thing that's waiting for me, how much longer I leave it waiting.
Yeah.
Reducing that stress is very valuable, but is that so relieving that I'm not recognizing that it's actually not that much better of a system? I don't know.
Huh.
The whole thing, this is just a prompt. I hopefully people will get a sense of like how they manage these sorts of things. Because it is hard to work on multiple projects, but like in all the ways I've done it, I still would never want to work on just one thing.
Sure.
Like I can't imagine a life of just working on one thing.
Oh, that's my dream. Well, I say that, but that's not true.
Yeah.
I think I would get anxious as well if I was just working on one thing.
Yeah.
Cause like that one thing cannot hold all the passion that I have.
Right.
However little that is.
Well, you gotta leave enough time for Dragon's Dogma too.
Right. exactly.
And when I say enough time, I mean a lot of time.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I think I'm in the 200s hours now with that game. Yeah, I think I've had a little bit of experience with working on multiple projects before.
Yeah.
At Future Club, it's really like long-term stuff. Like, I'll be working on a thing for 3 months and then we're working on another thing because an opportunity comes up.
Yeah.
And that doesn't, that's not the same thing. That's not really what you're talking about.
That's closer to my old life, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I kind of find that the way switching between things every 3 months to be more frustrating mm-hmm. than having two multiple projects at the same time.
Yeah.
Because I'll like spend a bunch of time thinking about this project and then all of a sudden have to switch my entire thinking around this whole new project. That adjustment time, like the wind up period, is like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's very frustrating.
Yeah.
Especially if you do it every few months, because uh-huh. then you're just like wasting 2 weeks switching between different things.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. But when in the past, when I worked at Pixel Lakes, I worked on a couple different things at the same time.
Yeah.
And
you had days that were one or the other. Now I'm remembering that. But I talked about it on the show, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I think what I did was I alternated between the days. I think the way you were doing is probably smarter, where you just work on it for 3 days and then 2 days.
Yeah.
Is that what I did? I don't remember. It's been so long, and it was also during, like, lockdown. Maybe I'm blocking that from my memory.
Yeah.
But at any rate, I kind of preferred that because then it was just segments, and I was like, this is the day I'm doing these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And it made sense, and there wasn't as much wind down. But also, as a result, I didn't spend a bunch of time outside of work thinking about work. I don't know. It sounds like you've kind of been experiencing that to some extent, because you get to this point and you're like, nope, I can section that off until the next week when I work on it.
And that's kind of the best you can get out of me, which is, you know, to leave my work at work, right?
Yeah.
Like, when I've had full-time jobs, I have been pretty good at that. Mm. Partly because I need the rest of my time for other stuff.
Yeah.
But where I'm choosing my projects and I really have a lot of personal and creative and financial investment in the success of these projects,
sure.
And I feel more ownership of them.
Yeah.
I will definitely, this is where I've cheated. Like, where I'm working on operators tomorrow, then I will work till 2 a.m. on Tuesday night in order so that I can work on operators tomorrow.
I see what you're saying.
You know, eventually, what does that mean? I'm waking up at 1 in the afternoon on Wednesday, and what good is that anyway?
Yeah.
Like, but you know, the arbitrary limits, the boundaries matter.
Yeah.
Because I need to contain my brain around it. Like, rather than just saying I'll quit and I'll do half a day on this tomorrow and that's a cheat. Like, I haven't learned that skill.
Well, sure, but you also like fit that into your schedule, right? The way you describe the operator's day is things keep coming up during Wednesdays that are probably gonna get in the way anyways. So it's okay if I don't spend a bunch of time on operators because I've already decided that operators will come out when it comes out and it's ready.
Yes, yes.
So it's done.
I used the wrong example because it was actually this week. It was Wednesday was Twin Cities playtest this week.
Yes.
And after it was over at 9:30 at night, I worked on operators for a couple more hours.
Oh, okay.
And then into the morning.
Oh, okay.
Because I knew I needed to get back on this other project.
Got it.
And I had a meeting today this week that was important that I needed to have food for. And yet I still, this is the real cheat. I still did work. I finished up some things on Thursday afternoon for operators. So like it's bursting at the seams a little bit.
Sure. But it's all arbitrary. I hope I'm not making it like breaking your idea of what this ideal thing.
No, I am. I'm very happy about it. I'm just skeptical of my satisfaction.
Sure.
I mean, I'm worried it's not going to last.
Okay.
And that's why I want to talk about the show, because I think I am curious to hear from listeners how they have managed their own thing. Because a lot of times people have like their main project and a side project.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's always been difficult for me, partly because I'm so, anything I'm doing now, I want to do forever.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to classify things as a side project. I'm working on it now.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Right? So one of the things that got lost in the shuffle is Roboston and Dogpile.
Yeah.
Those games are basically finished. They're pitchable. And I just do not have any time to write an email.
Only 7 days in a week.
To pitch it. And it feels really sad.
Yeah.
There just isn't time. And those are in a good place, but like they're just not high priority.
Yeah.
And that's a bummer. Mm-hmm. But if I didn't have a rigid structure, I would be thinking about if I could squeeze in an hour or two on this here or there. You know, benefits to sanity. Mm. But unfortunately, it means you're not going to see Roboston on shelves this year and probably not next either.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. That is kind of the nature of the beast, though.
Yeah. But I want to hear from the listeners about how they manage projects in their lives.
Yeah.
Is one enough? I mean, a lot of times one is too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Sometimes.
I mean, we talk about scope. That's a problem you never learn to solve. You know, you never get 100% great at. And so I want to hear how people handle people who are doing games nights and weekends and have a day job, people who work in a creative industry
yeah.
and then try to do creative things nights and weekends.
Yeah.
That's really hard.
Yeah.
That's maybe the hardest creative life to have.
Uh-huh.
And I want to hear everybody's stories.
Yeah.
So nicegames.club/discord, mm-hmm. please join us and share, because I'm just building a emotional support group, I think is what's happening. Because I'm doing a lot of this sort of in the abstract. I would like to know if people figured things out that I haven't even thought of.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, let us know. I want to hear that too.
There's a
yeah.
put a link in the that we're going to put in the show notes to. It's called the Eisenhower Matrix, which is the important/urgent matrix. It's one way you can like categorize the things that you want to do into like should you schedule it? Should you do it? Like then the other thing that was really there's a really cool book and I can't remember the title of it. Is it like Days in the Lives of Creative? See if I can find it. Aha, Daily Rituals, How Artists Work by Mason Curry.
Okay.
And this is like little tiny paragraph to page long vignettes on just like how different creative people and whatever, like throughout history, the last few hundred years, structured their time.
That's fun.
Yeah. So some interesting reading for listeners before they get on Discord and tell us what they do.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and children's feedback. It's a pretty cute story. Reply on the various platforms or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.